This week on the Drag Zine Podcast, we talked to David Reese about setting the 275 radio record, his radio versus the world racing past, grudge racing, time with Phil Schuler, and a whole lot more. So, pull those belts tight. Get ready to put it in the beams. The Drag Zine Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Drag Zine Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. This week on the show, David Reese stops by after he kind of dropped a bomb on the radial tire world with posting the first of the 360s video with a spooled media, and kind of jumps into why he did it when he did it and the fact that, you know, he really doesn't care what anybody else wants to think. He just wants to go fast. So it's definitely a pretty interesting interview. So if you want to get a little peek into what goes on in the grudge world and a whole lot more, stay tuned and let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Drag Zine Podcast is David Reese, who recently reset a record on 275 radials and has done a whole lot of racing in other locations and places. What's going on, David?
Not much.
Thanks. Thanks for coming on the show. You know, before we get to the record talk, I think what we need to do is kind of set the table behind what you do and what you've been racing, because a lot of people, I don't think they really kind of know because of, you know, your grudge racing past and everything else you've done. And you're not exactly the loudest person on earth. You like to let your car do all the talking, am I right?
Correct.
Now, kind of, how did this whole thing kind of get set about? Because you mentioned before, you know, when we were doing our pre-call, that you used to race, you know, radio versus the world and whatnot. You know, what kind of led you into getting into, you know, heads up in radio racing?
Well, I ran 10.5 back in the early 2000s, back when it started. And as the 10.5 evolved, my pocketbook kind of dwindled. I ended up kind of backing up a couple classes, Limited Street. They came out with a class called Easy Street that was the first class drag radial related that they run on a 295 drag radial. That was in 07. And basically we built a car and to run Orsica Easy Street. Had good success. It kind of was in the limelight. We won 11, 12, 14 races in a row. And at the kind of the end of the season, I had a wreck at a small track we were doing some racing at, and totaled a car and broke my back. And we ended up building a car to replace that one to go on to win a championship at Orsica. But that car actually I sold to David Hance with the twin turbo first car in the quarter. And I think it changed hands to Andrew Aleppa and then Fletcher Cox. And then now I think it's in Australia somewhere. But so I got out of drag radio racing and started running small track outlaw pro modified blower stuff for the next 4, 5, 6 years. And had an accident and kind of put me out of drag racing for a while. And, you know, kids grew up, and I had always built race cars, but I've been a manufacturing manager for the better part of the last, at that point, 6, 7 years. When I got my kids grew up and moved out, I decided I was going to try to start racing again. My younger brother built a car, RVW, our blue vet. We raced it for a little while on big tire and kind of converted it back to the radial stuff. And run one or two races with a drag radial, and he ended up wanting to sell it. So we sold it turnkey to Leroy Neighbors. And had my mindset was to just stay racing, but my brother, he was kind of wanting to do it less, and so basically I had talked to Phil. He was helping us at the time with a no-time friend of mine, and I told him I wanted to build a car that would, you know, that we could race and that he could help with, you know. He didn't feels real loyal to his program, and he didn't want to race against any of his work. So I built the 275 car, and from then on, it just kind of took off into the no time.
So that's Phil Schuler, who works with Stevie Jackson and does the NHRA stuff, right?
Yes, correct. Yep. And Phil, you know, he's a big grudge racer, ex-grudge racer. They're always talking, you know, how Stevie is. And so he was just right up his alley. And I talked to him and said, hey, I want to build a car that, you know, you can help me with and kind of on your off weekends and we can go do it. And that's kind of why we started towards the no time. And we put the car together. I built it here in the shop. It was the first, my first full-time Reese Brothers shop car. And we kind of built it to kind of promote the business, prove that I could build the car in a timely manner, put a program together, and make it competitive.
Now, was that Mustang you were running, or was that the Camaro?
The Camaro.
Okay, so that's El Diablo. I love that name.
Correct. Yeah, and Phil, he actually came up with that name. We kind of ran the car. Didn't have all the no-time guys, they all had names for the cars and stuff. Phil liked that, and he thought it would be a pretty good deal.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. I didn't even realize how long you've been in the whole small tire and radial, you know, the grudge scene. Kind of looking at that, what's the biggest change that you've seen from when all of this insanity started to the level it's at now with this level of racing?
You know, the biggest thing I've seen change is track prep. You know, I think track prep has come a long ways. I think converter technology has come a long ways. And definitely from the power management side of it, there's a lot more of that going around. And it just makes for a good competitive race.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's definitely interesting to see the whole evolution of how quickly this has happened to other forms of racing and, you know, how long it took to break barriers and, like, you know, nitro racing compared to how quickly you guys are doing it on radials. It's kind of terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. The it's weird now, you know, for me, I run in radial and also pro mod, and the, you know, from where the parts come from on the blower side of it, you know, all the technology that we're doing is like top alcohol, top door slammer, you know, on our side of it. I don't know about the turbo aspect of it, but it seems like, you know, it just seems to me like everything's kind of coming full circle back to things that you would think could never have happened 6-7 years ago. I mean, and I was doing it myself in a Outlaw Pro Mod. I mean, I go 390s then. I just thought that was the fastest thing. And then we moved on into Pro Extreme, and I could run 370 there. And I'd set passwords off of my fastest ET, you know what I mean? Oh. But now it's just kind of we just blow way past it. Just speaks a lot for, you know, tire technology and tracks and power management.
And, you know, kind of diving into that a little bit more, you know, it's always interesting to talk to racers that use the different, you know, power adders and whatnot. And blower cars to me just fascinate me the most because they're the most loud, angry, and obnoxious cars out there. And from the way, you know, I've talked with drivers, they're a little bit of a different animal to drive. You know, would you agree with that statement?
Well, I think that it's loud. And yes, I think it's aggressive. But there's not a lot of things going on. It's not as complicated of a racing operation as it would be with a turbo, where you require on multiple things to limit boost. And ours are pretty much engine speed related. You know, if you rev the motor up, it makes more boost. So to me, like, yeah, they're loud, and yes, they're abrupt. But on the tuning side of it, I feel like they're the easiest.
Yeah, that's, you know, Tom Bailey talked about that going from driving his, you know, turboed drag week car to driving that blown pro mod for skinny kid. And, yeah. You know, you kind of talked about the staging procedure. You said it's night and day difference. It's like, you know, the turbo pro mod, there's a million things going on. You said the blower car, you just basically stick it in the beams, jam it to the floor, and hold on.
That's correct, yeah.
And
you won't be sitting there on the start line worried about where the boost is going to be at.
No, because it's pretty much you mash the pedal, and that thing's like a little hyperactive kid. It's wound up and ready to roll.
Correct, yeah.
And you mentioned kind of, you know, the tuning side of the things. What kind of insight can you kind of maybe let, you know, talk about that people might not know about, you know, the tuning side of these things on, you know, you don't have like a turbo car with like your typical boost controller and whatnot, you know, how do you make these wild boosted blown animals behave themselves from a tuning standpoint?
Mostly with fuel and timing. That's the only thing we mess with, fuel and timing. You give it a lot of fuel and take timing away, it just blubbers it. So I think it's the most tunable set of, you know, the most tunable combinations that there is.
So it's a matter of just making sure that you've got, you're walking that tightrope right to, based on the conditions that you're bringing in a fuel and spark to not only keep it happy, but make power and then not overpower the track.
That's correct.
And another thing I've kind of noticed too is a lot of guys are starting to get away from, you know, what you might have seen originally with blower cars with magnetos, and you're starting to see a lot more of the EFI and kind of the coil on plug deal. You know, what do you think the future is with that?
I mean, we tested with a coil on plug this year, the end of the year was on El Diablo, with Fuel Tech. We've had, you know, great success as far as the spark duration is a lot much longer. I still am not won over that it's more or greater than a 44 mag, but I think the digital side of it, it's just a more accurate firing sequence, and I think that helps it. And the longer duration, I believe, just fires all the excess fuel within the cylinder, so it makes for a cleaner setup, which, you know, we use fuel to make them leave the start line to kill power. The hardest thing we fight is trying to keep it all lit, and with the magneto, it's helping. I mean, with the coil on plug, it's helping us do that.
And I imagine, too, it's probably giving you a lot more precise control and kind of more data on what you can see on what it's doing.
Yeah, it does. You know, Fuel Tech kind of gives you an abundance of information. To me, I don't think it's the simplest form of coil on plug that there is now. But I think it works good. Every setup has its pros and cons. Where there's some small things we don't care about with the Fuel Tech. The other things now with the CDI and the MSD stuff, where it's more exact to what we've done in the past with our MSD stuff. So all of those things, what make us lean a little towards the MSD, just it's more like what we're accustomed to seeing.
Right on. That totally makes sense, because it's something you're comfortable with and can kind of, you know that warm, fuzzy feeling and what it likes and, you know, how to make it work.
Yeah, well, we run in the past with race pack and MSD, so we're accustomed to seeing race pack data. The Fuel Tech data logs, just like the race pack, you can actually take the race pack off. But the data is a little bit skewed. It's not what we're looking at, are used to looking at with race pack.
Oh, right on. That makes
sense. So that takes a little bit of getting used to, but in the big picture, it serves the purpose and actually functions, you know.
And, you know, all of that kind of plays in as well. It's interesting, you know, with the blowers, that the different setups, that even what goes behind the engine as far as, the, you know, your converter and your transmission technology to kind of make all that work with the radial tire. How has that changed over the years for, you know, with, you know, your experiences, what you've seen?
Well, you know, as I talk about converter technology, it's come a long ways. what we had, you know, 15 years ago. And I think that that's helping. Ratio-wise, the availability of different ratios has, you know, has come full circle also. So I think that, you know, that's what all of it's about is ratio and horsepower.
Yeah, and kind of keeping it happy on that tire and keep that tire right on the edge of sticking and spinning, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that, you know, on the – I never would have thought that the 275 would have been as good a tire as it is. I've ran 315 stuff before, and I've ran the 295 stuff. So I feel like for sure that they are, you know, all of them are good, but like the 275, I guess the size of it, just looking at it, you're thinking, man, there's no way that thing will hold that much power, but it sure does it.
Yeah. Let's talk about that record right now. Cause I was up at the World Cup, you know, I was at New Mercy, and then I went to the World Cup where, you know, Bill Lutz set the quarter mile record on a 275 tire where he went like six flat at 240 something, which is just, that's insane. Yeah. And he was trying to dip into the fives, but the car started fighting him big, and I was actually at the top end, the nose collapsed on it. But that's a whole different thing, trying to go that, you know, run the quarter mile on a 275. And then you went, what, a 369 at what, 208?
Yeah, see, we've changed quite a bit since El Diablo came out. It started life with a Hemi with a roots blower. Ran really well then. We kind of got caught up in the no time stuff when I kind of got sidetracked from what the car was actually built for. I was doing so well racing it that I kind of lost sight of what I actually built the car to do, which was promote the business. I feel like records create talk. I think that all talk is good talk. You're always going to have people out there that feel you should have done it different, or, and I'm okay with that. It doesn't change the end result. But we had kind of give up the first of the 70s by not posting times. And it didn't really matter, I guess, in the grudge world. I just seen that after that happened, it doesn't really matter what you run. All people care about is if you're winning or losing. So, you know, when we came over to, you know, like run that first in the seat, like I've made test passes when I first put the screw on. I don't really like, I never wanted to post a time slip that one of the grudge guys was beside me on. Okay. So when I chose that run at Ducks Race to post first in the 60s, I've sold the car now. The new owner was okay with it. It's for sure going to be a class car in the future. So I wanted to post a time. We had planned to go to Orlando, but because of work, I wasn't able to go. I never wanted to be the guy that had cars sitting there in his shop and I was at the racetrack racing. That's not what I wanted to do from a chassis standpoint. I wanted to fulfill my obligation here in the shop and then be able to go race. So I didn't get to go. But I didn't want to lose first of the 60s. You know, I wanted the car to be able to get some recognition, the shop to get some recognition. Phil, he doesn't care. He doesn't care if it's, doesn't care about recognition. He's a loyal grudge guy.
Phil just wants to crack skulls and take money. That's all he
wants
to do.
Yeah, that's all he wants to do. Phil's pretty cut and dry. He's going to tell you right the way it is. And that's awesome. That guy right there is, like I tell everybody, he's the only person that I know that likes drag racing more than I do. So he's a good dude for sure. But yeah, I wanted to post a time. But we've been pull the parachute at the 8th mile and go into fives. So like I've been 5.93 with the chutes out at the 8th mile.
Holy cow, for a quarter mile run?
It was an 8-mile run, but they had the quarter mile clocks on.
Oh wow!
Like I have many time slips, but it wasn't really. I wasn't out to like be the first in the fives. I don't care about quarter mile. I'm telling you, when I let go of the button, the first thing I want to do is pull the parachute. So I don't care nothing about no quarter mile racing. That's not for me.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a different animal when you're on a small tire, right?
That's correct, yeah. And, you know, a lot of people, we built this car, and everybody says, oh, it's fast because it's light. Well, sometimes you just let them talk. But the car's not really that light. I mean, it's a steel roof, steel quarters, factory back glass. I mean, it's light. It's lighter than a class rules, but it still weighs 2,600 pounds on me in it. So I did, you know, by the time we changed to the new engine, we put a Noonan 4.9 engine in it 2 months ago, and we put a Liberty in it. And we've only got 14 runs on it, but, like, it's never been slower than 375.
That's just – that's crazy. And it's even crazier considering, you know, the car run, you know, ran, you know, clocks off for so long, and it can be kind of hard to judge those cars. And with that Liberty in there, hearing that thing do multiple shifts, I mean, it was it's definitely an impressive and nasty car with that screw on it.
Yeah. I can tell you that Phil is the best at – tuning to the guy in the other lane. So, like, every grudge race we've won, every no time event we've won, we've barely won. Phil is the best at not showing his hand.
And I think that's what makes grudge racing interesting as well, is that you don't know what the other person has in the other lane at all. And even if they showed times, it still doesn't tell the whole story of what that car might or might not be capable of.
Yeah, that's correct. That's right.
And, you know, kind of going off of that, you start seeing some of the chatter on the internet about that. You know, some people seem, you know, again, it's social media. People get upset when grudge cars post times, all this, you know, they act like it's the biggest apocalypse ever, because you might have ran against someone that sat the same or this, that, and the other. And to me, it's more of, you know, you need to worry about your own program. If someone showed a time, that's fine, but that's, you know, if you're complaining about it, you're kind of showing your hand, right?
Well, I'm gonna be honest, you know, I didn't like it either, you know, when Corey and them showed their time, and Justin, because they're at a no time event. They took a no-time ticket, and I didn't like that. I didn't think it was good for the grudge world. But, you know, and then here I did the same thing. So I don't think it's correct way to do it. But for me, like, the car sold. I'm not saying that I just rolled over just because the car sold. It's just that it's gonna come out in a class anyway. And like I said, we were already planning to go down there. Before I sold the car, I had planned to go to Orlando. I was going to run an RVW. But I just, when the car sold, the owner told me I could take it. But I just didn't feel like I should go and run it. I didn't want to risk tearing it up. I didn't want to mess with my money, if it makes any sense.
Well, yeah, for sure. That's the last thing you want to do is sell a car then. Pile it up. That'd be about the worst thing ever to happen.
Yeah, I mean, but I just didn't want to. And when everyone go to talking about, you know, cars, the fastest 275 cars, I mean, here I am. I know it seems like those guys they're mad on Facebook and social media, but like I said, all talk is good talk. As long as they keep talking, then I'm good with it. But it's not really as big a excitement for me, because, like, I've known it for a year that I was the fastest.
Yeah, it's old hat, and you've been able to keep that under control. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was definitely interesting to start to see that video kind of make its posts on social media. We'll share it on the Dragzine part of this podcast on the article, but. You know, you get some people that really, you know, they get cranky about it because, you know, there was no clocks on. It's just a ticket, yada, yada, yada. But at the same time, you know, what's not to say that you could just, all right, you know, turn on the clocks and then light it up with the same number or even potentially quicker?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, That car is much faster. You know, that's why I didn't really much worry. I just wanted to be first in the 60s. If I can promise you one thing, people can talk all they want to talk. But if there was someone that was faster than that, they would have already posted their time slip.
Oh, yeah, for sure. They'd have been like, well, no, I'm the fastest.
Yeah, and people talk. They say, oh, we can make time slips. We can do that. You're right, you can. But that's not me. Just like I told, Ziff, he's extra mad. I mean, I don't know why Ziff's extra mad at me, but he's mad because the car, he already knows the thing's fast. He's just creating drama that I don't care about hearing, you know?
Now, you know, it went that fast on a 275. You know, yeah. What's the difference? Do you think it could go faster on a 315 or a 295? Or, you know, why is the 275 seem to be that magical tire?
I'm going to be honest with you. Like, I don't feel like the 315, I think the 315 would be faster, properly ratioed. The car should run exactly what RVW cars run. It has the same spot. It has the same parts on it. So I feel like, yes, the 315, it would be faster with some runs. But we started it as a 275, so we've kind of just stuck with it from that. I mean, we've been, it's been 210 mile per hour. And it's been 250 flat to the 330, you know. So, like, if I put all of my quickest numbers together, I think the thing could go 62 or 3 with a 275.
That's just insane to think about. That, you know, the limiting factor in drag radio racing has always been, oh, it's the tire, oh, it's the tire. And somehow racers just continually find ways to go insanely fast on these tires that aren't supposed to go that fast.
I would tell you, we race, we race to go fast. I mean, I don't think that anyone out there, I can tell you, if you go to the racetrack with Phil Shuler, he's there to smash dreams.
Oh, totally.
And there's no, now I will say he's the smartest racer tuner I know. Like, there's been times when I felt like we could go faster, and he's like, you don't have to go faster. So he kind of keeps me retained. Like, I want to go fast as I go every time. And he's the smartest racer there is.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of, you know, having that extra force reining you in, because racers always want to shake a tail feather, but that's, you know, the way that, yep. You know, in the grudge world, people get scared of you. In the class world, you know, you win those lead-plated trophies.
That's correct. Yep. Yeah, we want to go to the racetrack, be competitive, and win. You know, it's next year. I've kind of got a deal put together. Well, I do have a deal put together with Rick Thornton with FFI, and we're going to run two cars in RVW next year. I'll have one new one out by the race in February. And hopefully the second one by Sweet 16.
Okay. Yeah. What are you gonna have going on with those cars?
They'll be RVW screw blown small blocks. And again, we're just kind of trying to go with something that, you know, Rick, he likes the small block. He wants to go with something that he feels like the weight's key, is paramount. And I agree with him, because I see kind of on the back lines, you know, all the Hemi stuff, they're breaking drive lines, and because the weight, man, it's just so difficult. It's not really that it is difficult to go fast with the weight, but what's difficult, I think, is to keep the parts in the car. Like, the more weight you stack on a car, something's going to fail driveline-wise, you know. And I just think that, you know, for that, with that, we think that the small block's going to be better because it's not going to be so heavy.
You just dropped a lot of knowledge bombs right there, like carpet bomb, B-52 knowledge bombs that I don't think a lot of people realize that when you go radial class racing, especially radial versus the world racing, is that it takes a deep pocketbook, but it takes a smart pocketbook. And the fact that you guys are looking at those small blocks kind of makes sense because it gives you those advantages, especially in the weight department, because then, you know, that probably opens up your door quite a bit for your tuning window on chassis stuff because you can sling more weight around, right?
Yeah. I started helping Rick post Sweet 16 this year. He struggled. They had a motor. They have two engines that Rear Morrison has designed and made for in conjunction with Rick. Small block, 4/6 bore space, screw blown deals. And really, that's a lot of the reason that I went to the Fuel Tech this year was just to gain knowledge to tune on Rick's small block. So Rick brought me the car. We took it to the track here local, done some testing with it, and we got it pretty close. Like, it'll go bottom 70s, you know, pretty regularly at 2450. Now, we don't feel like we have the most horsepower. It's just a lot more difficult to get the car to the finish line with a lighter weight than I thought it would be. And the car tries to kind of pinball, for lack of better terms. It just, yes, they're light, but you got to think, you still have roughly 3,000 horsepower you're trying to get to the finish line with very minimal downforce. Oh, the only downforce that we create is what we create with the chassis, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely interesting to see how all these different combinations kind of have to work together, the pros and cons of it. And I think, you know, what you mentioned with, you know, the big motor Hemi stuff with the weight, that you know, then you have a different set of problems where you're trying to overcome that weight with the horsepower. And sure, you can make all the horsepower in the world, but everything behind it sometimes, it doesn't want to be part of the program or party, and it starts breaking in a hurry.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the weight creates downforce and drag. The motor, you know, is going to make X amount of power. And, like, the more downforce and the more, you know, the more traction you have, the harder it is on stuff. It tries to throw shit out of there, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, and that's really what we've, you know, I'm excited about the new deal because, I'm going to be able to get back to the RVW stuff that I wanted to do. And I can tell you that if it takes deep pockets to do it, I probably won't do it long because I don't have deep pockets. But, we're going to give it a go. And Rick is the best guy to work with. He's kind of low key, doesn't push. He's okay with when we get done. It's never been, we have to be done. I'm the one that wants it to get done. So, I just want to, you know, I think it's going to be great. I'm excited about working with Rick this year. Even the small block deal, they got the weight at like 2,400 pounds. We might need to be at 2,300 to be competitive, but we'll have to see when we get there.
And it's interesting again, you know, with the whole, you know, it takes cubic dollars to go fast, but at the same time, I think that there needs to also be a certain level of emphasis put on the ability to have the knowledge, because you could have the biggest budget on earth, but if you don't have the tuning knowledge, you know, you're wasting your money.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, what do you think is one of the big things that is really the key to tuning on these radial tire cars that would surprise a lot of, you know, just your average fan? You know, what do you think is something that would make them go, oh, wow, that's pretty wild?
Can I repeat the question again? I didn't follow.
No, you know, your average fan sitting in the stands at one of Duck's races, you know, what's something that they might find kind of interesting or surprising about what you have to do to tune one of these radial tire cars?
Well, I think, you know, from the stands, you see these guys leave, okay? You're like, man, that car's quick or it's fast, but you don't really know what it takes to get it to leave that fast. So if you look at a turbo car that would leave on 12 or 13 pounds of boost and be really fast. And just imagine that the screw-blown cars make 50 pounds on the two-step. If they knew the amount of power that we're, like, we have to make 50 pounds to make the same power they make at 20 pounds. So, but the way the blower stuff is set up, it's going to make a lot of boost early. So just being able to manage it to get it down the track is amazing to me.
Oh, yeah, and it's a matter of being able, like you said, the interesting dichotomy is the amount of boost and the amount of power that they make, that where the turbo cars are trying to make them take off and be angry and, be quick, and while the blower cars, you guys are trying to find a way to just manage that horsepower so it doesn't kick the tires or, try to send the front end into low orbit.
Yep. I think that for me, the fans don't, all they see is the end result of the weights, and I think Donald's done great at making the class competitive. I think in a lot of cases he's caused money to be spent, but it just shows the competitiveness that all the racers have about, winning. They'll do whatever it takes to win.
Oh, it's insane, especially, the Sweet 16 Home Run Derby, where you get like 35 qualifiers, and by the final qualifying session, if you're looking to collect scrap aluminum, you just roll through the pits and start picking up busted parts, because there's a lot of guys that just destroy stuff in that race.
Yeah, I can tell you that, I tuned for the Deckers this past Sweet 16 race, and it's definitely hard on parts. It's just that's how I know what it takes to keep parts within the car. It's people don't realize what 100 pounds will do to one. You put 100 pounds on one, it may slow it down a couple numbers, but it's going to break stuff.
Horsepower finds the weakest link to break in different aspects, especially you start adding weight and it just starts stressing things in the drive line that you wouldn't think would normally break, and then it breaks and you're like, oh well, I wasn't expecting that to happen.
Yeah, we broke stuff and be like, man, where did that come from? We never even serviced that part.
Yeah, it's almost like for that race in particular, you need to create a completely separate maintenance plan just to keep it alive for if you're going to try to make all the rounds of qualifying, which some people do, some people don't. Again, it kind of plays in the strategy side of things, and that's something you got to think about there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say that Donald's races are a war of attrition. You have to make it to the finish line.
Oh, yeah.
Hold on one thing. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely, you have to have a very solid race strategy besides just, wanting to be Ricky Bobby and go fast, because, these cars, they are mechanical machines and parts break, and not having a good plan, as far as qualifying and how you want to handle eliminations and, how much you want to lean on it, that'll come back and bite you.
Yeah.
Kind of looking back at, all these different races, these years you've raced, I'm going to put you on the spot here. What's the wildest thing you've ever seen happen on a set of radial tires when you're at the track, or just, at the track in general, something where you were just like, oh, wow, that was interesting.
Radial only. I would say, Ferris with a twin 88, 220 plus mile per hour. Same thing, I mean, there's a couple of them. The Mark Mickey, just amazing how fast mile per hour those things go. It's just, and that just proves how close Donald's got the rules to know that, the turbo stuff, they make so much horsepower, Stevie always makes that 1,000 horsepower switch accusation, but I think that's accurate. I think they have so much power, they can just flip a switch and have a bunch right there.
Well, what's wild about, the Mark Mickey passes, that's pretty much just like a big, it's a big block Chevy-ish architecture that they have there. It's not one of these, big gnarly Hemi cars.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it just proves technology, I think that the big block Chevy is the geometry wise, I think it's superior to the Hemi. Now, some of the later Hemi stuff, the 4.9 Noonan stuff, they really focus on geometry, and they're just making the motors happier. Now, a Hemi, they make power, but you got to think a Hemi's a small engine. It's only 520 inches, you know. So it flows a lot of air, and by flowing air, but with a small deal, it just makes power differently. And I think that the Chevy stuff is better, in my opinion.
And when you're talking about geometry, you're talking about like your valve train geometry and stuff like that, right?
Valve train geometry, rod ratio, all things.
And kind of talking off of that, what I find interesting is in this job, I've started to be able to start picking up a lot more technical knowledge that I normally didn't have. And when you talk about valve train geometry, you talk to some of these engine builders about that and push rods and how all that works. And you never, as a casual fan at the time, I never realized how important that geometry is, because if you start getting a push rod rocker arm issue where things aren't happy, that leads to a whole other set of problems that you're not wanting to deal with. It gets expensive really quick.
Yeah, I can tell you that the outtrain geometry issues will put the biggest woes on your racing program of anything in racing other than oiling issues. And generally, they go hand in hand.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that before where guys have had oiling issues and it starts burning up push rods and they're chasing their tail trying to figure it out. And you kind of step back and sometimes realize how closest go hand in hand, and just you start having a push rod that starts getting a little dance happy on that rocker, and that's when things start moving and bending in ways they're not meant to, and then that just pretty much starts snapping parts you don't want to have snapped.
Correct.
And then you get that figured out and people start cranking up more boosting. Speaking of Mark, Mickey at Tyler's race a couple years ago, they had one of the most gnarly engine issues I've ever seen, where he literally drove over the crank. Like, the crank's hanging out of the bottom of the engine. They're dragging the car back to the pits. You hear like the oil pan scraping. They go back and you see, the monumental thrash to get the car ready. And just the pictures of that block in the aftermath were just, it was awe-inspiring. Yeah. And man, I felt bad for them on that deal.
Yeah, I can tell you, I hate to see anybody tear anything up. I know what it cost to put motors back in, and I hate to see anybody tear that stuff up.
Oh yeah, it's definitely not fun to do that, for sure. And I find it interesting too that you've done both pro mod and radial racing on slicks and radials. What's your take on the difference between driving on the big old steamrollers versus driving on the old street tires?
Yeah, I can tell you that you can make a 390 run on a slick, and it's much more eventful than a 370 run on a radial. Everything about, the chassis setups is different. You name it, it's different.
Yeah, and the slicks seem to be a lot more dance happy, and the faster you go, the worse it gets, right?
Yeah. The big tire stuff, you have to have tire speed early. With the radial stuff, you have no tire speed early. With the big tire stuff, you have a bunch of timing early and then take timing away. And then with the radio stuff, you have no timing early and then put timing in. So it's totally both ends of the spectrum.
The thing that it's sort of interesting, if you think about this, is how did people discover that? Because before, everybody was racing on slicks, and this radio stuff started coming around. You got to think that there's someone out there that started that whole trend to make it happen, and then everybody else started going around it. What kind of experimenting do you do as a tuner to find, things like that, looking at finding new ways to go fast?
Well, I tune different than most people. Like, I have to go to the finish line, so I always start less aggressive and then go towards the more aggressive side. Some people swing for the fence. They start on the more aggressive side. And, the ones that talk and tell what they're doing, I guess gives me comfort in trying to put more in, but I don't try to put a bunch in early.
Yeah, I was always kind of interested in seeing how tuners look at that stuff because there's, you know, you've got to sometimes, it kind of plays back to what we were talking about, you know, hitting these peaks in performance that you've gone so far and it's like, well, what do we do now? You know, how, you know, do you take a big leap and try to get kind of crazy with things and possibly tear parts up? Or, you know, do you use some logic in how you try to maybe do something different? You know, how would you approach that situation?
Well, I mean, I think it has to do with your program. You know, for me, I have to take baby steps, mainly because I can't afford to tear it up. So I tiptoe around it, and I try to do the same with everyone that I help. Try to treat their stuff just like it's my own. And a lot of times, and we, you know, kind of back to the grudge racing and no time stuff, you know, you don't always have to be the fastest. You just have to go to the finish line, you know.
Oh, yeah. If you can make A to B passes in pretty much every condition, you know, they don't have to be the fastest A to B pass, but just having that ability to go down the track puts you in an advantage to win on so many different levels.
Yeah, it's like I tell the guys that we grudge race, you know, do what you got to do, but you're not going to beat me on the start line. You got to beat me at the finish line.
Yeah, you cut that good light, and then it plays into another team strategy because there's a lot of people that say they're only racing the track only, but if you're going against someone that you know can go A to B, then you start playing the game, well, do I want to put more in it? You know, if you make a mistake, they're going to make you pay. So it can benefit you to be that team that can get down the track all the time because it's going to win you more races than lose them.
Yeah, great. That's what I feel.
And it's interesting then when you look at something like, you know, what Phil does, you know, with the fuel racing, that's a completely different animal because they're out there just, you know, trying to find ways to make things go faster that we can't comprehend, all while trying to keep a motor that's trying to violently destroy itself in the process.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what makes Phil very versatile is, and any tuner, not just Phil, but anyone that can work on multiple combinations and multiple areas and multiple air situations, it just makes you better. That's all it could do.
Yeah, you have data and experience from a lot of different situations where it might be, you know, you're tuning on a turbo car, but you're like, well, I've seen something similar with a blower car in this application. Maybe we can slot, you know, it's doing this here, it liked it there, maybe that'll work here. You know, it's having that ability to know what stuff likes and slide it in there and make it work.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you're getting ready to go back to Radio versus the World, and I always like to hear, you know, you're given a blank check. If there was any other kind of racing, you know, you know, would you want to go nitro racing, pro stock racing, pro mod racing again? You know, what would you want to do besides Radio versus the World if you really had the...
If it was a blank check situation, I would like to run pro boost.
Oh, right on.
Or pro stock. So,
why those two classes?
I just like the cars. I like the way they look, and the competitiveness. The level of competition is everyone's real close. Like there's no heroes and no zeros. Like you can go to a race and four or five numbers will separate number one and number 16. To me, I like that type of racing. I don't like the standout, I got the most money type of racing.
Oh yeah, in both of those classes, it doesn't matter what your budget is, you can get humbled really quick because, like you said, there's only a few numbers separating some of the top people, and it's pretty gnarly when you watch those, you know, pro stock and pro boost for sure.
Yeah, I think it, you know, like Stevie running pro mod at a NHRA at a professional level, I mean, it's got to help him making laps. I mean, every time he sits in the car, he's making laps. I think that helps, even him in the RVW stuff.
Oh yeah, it's like any professional, you know, a stick and ball sport is that muscle memory that it becomes. You kind of feel it coming before it happens, and you're able to do things that people, you know, they go, well, how did he do that? Well, it's experience. That's what you gain from putting so many laps in so many different cars.
Correct.
And, you know, speaking of Stevie, Brian Lones posted something on Facebook about what he did in Pro Mod, and you know, I keep telling people if he ever goes nitro racing, that's going to be the big three teams' worst nightmare is that man in a nitro car, hands down.
Yeah, I would say that Stevie has he's got a drive that I think very few professional drivers do. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I would speculate that most professional drivers, you don't really hear them like coming up through the ranks. I mean, they kind of just buy in. They're there. When they leave, they go back to work and they do some other job. But for a guy that's worked on cars and tuned on cars and drove cars and to make it to go through the ranks and to be at that level, I think that's what's going to make Stevie do better than most.
Yeah, it's like he's almost like a southern version of John Force, basically.
Yeah, correct. I mean, he's just and you know, the not the arrogance. I think that I would say more than the attitude. Stevie, I think he appears arrogant sometimes, but just Stevie. I don't think it's an arrogance thing. I think it's just a confidence thing. He has to be that confident in what he's doing to be able to cash that check his mouth just wrote.
Oh yeah, he knows if he's saying he's got to find a way to make it happen. And you know, there's some racers that are like that. Then you know, there's some racers that you know they walk softly and carry a big camshaft, and that yeah. you don't know what's going to happen to you till they've already done it to you, right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean Steve, you know we raced together in Orsica, and he kind of come up right behind me. I kind of got off. To me, it's amazing outside looking in that. He's gone where he's gone. Just a testament that anyone, you know, like put in the correct situations can make it happen, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the coolest thing about Stevie and even Phil. You know, Phil raced for a long time, but I never even knew him. I never knew Phil raced at House of Hook or Jackson Dragway. I mean, I didn't know that. I didn't know Phil from Adam till a year and a half, 2 years ago, and now I talk to him every day, 10, 12 times a day.
And, yeah, it's interesting how that kind of plays out. And, you know, it comes down to that experience and, you know, being that person that, you know, that can read what a track's going to do because you've been in that position so many times and you know kind of instinctively, all right, well, XYZ is happening. We got to put this tune-up in it. And, it works.
Yeah, I mean, I was worried, you know, Phil, he had a change in Denver and he wasn't going to be able to be at Lights Out or No Mercy this year. And I was all worried because, I mean, I was having to tune other cars and drive mine. And he said, I don't know why you're worried. And he said, you made the best passes you've ever made when I wasn't there. So it goes back to talking to Phil. Like every time we're at the racetrack, if we're looking at the start line or in between runs or just hanging out the trailer, we're always talking about racing stuff. It's for me I listen and learn and I retain things that most people don't realize that I do, and to just to be around Phil and even Stevie on a small caliber. I don't really talk to Stevie that much, but like if we're at the racetrack and something breaks and I need something welded, Phil calls me, hey, get over here. And for me, that's cool just to be able to go over there to their pit and be able to help them. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah. It's, you know, like mine's, you know, I'm about the biggest drag racing nerd idiot on earth. If I had the time and option, I'd, you know, literally spend every minute at the track. And it's when you're around people like that, it becomes infectious and you start coming up with ways to do different things. And it really makes it that much more enjoyable to be at the track all the time when you're around people like that.
Oh yeah, I agree.
You know, I always tell people, you know, it's my job's a lot of work and there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes and a lot of time it has to be put in. But when I sit back now and look at this year and what I've got to check out drag racing wise, I got to go to the biggest no prep race in the world, Out Armageddon. Got to go to two of Duck's races, got to go to the U.S. Nationals, and got to go to the World Cup, which is arguably one of the best events in drag racing as well. The only thing that I didn't get to cross off, two things I didn't get to do to cover literally every ounce of drag racing, was go to a really big grudge race and go to one of the big you know, big money bracket races, which if I had the time, I would do that too.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, you know, like the no prep deal kind of taking off. We're actually doing a call for Larry Roach. We just took it to Powder Coat today.
Oh, right on.
For next year. So he's been trying to get me to go to one of those races, and I just can't make time. Oh. Other than the fact I just don't like no prep. I mean, but he says the track's pretty good. But just, I guess, what they call it, no prep, I struggle to even try to go to a racetrack that I know for sure when I get there it's going to have nothing on it.
It's a misnomer. I talked with Dwayne Mills about this. Basically, what no prep, like what the majority of no prep racing is these days, is just trying to take a modern car that makes 3,000 horsepower and put it down a track that has track prep from 25 years ago. That's really all it is.
Yeah, which is probably like what I've been doing in the Outlaw Pro Mod stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it's like.
I can tell you, you know, you run mid-80s at Holiday Beach in Alabama, you've done something.
Yeah, you're holding on for dear life. And, you know, that's to me, that at first I thought no prep was, I'm like, this has got to be the dumbest thing on earth. And then I went to one of the races and it clicked. I'm like,
you know what makes it not dumb? All the people that are there.
Oh, it's insane. It's insane.
Yeah.
And
that alone would make it cool.
And the way that I describe it to people is it's a lot like old school drag racing, where people have their fans. And I know some people don't like Street Outlaws, which is fine, but what they've done for the sport is immeasurable. And you have people that are there, you have your Street Outlaw fans cheering for them, then you have the people yelling for the non-Street Outlaws, the real, what they consider no prep people. And it's just this electric environment that the only thing close to it would be probably either Ducks races or the World Cup, which the World Cup is just, you know, there's 10,000 plus people there a day screaming and yelling. It's a totally different environment when you're racing in front of that many freaking people.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, that's what makes it cool. I mean, that's what makes Ducks races cool, is the amount of people that are there.
Oh, yeah. It's a different deal when you have that many people, that like fans, like rabid fans. I've been to some of the No Prep King races, and say what you will about that, anything off the track might be, you know, slightly, I hate the word scripted, but it's made to fit better for TV. But when they roll those things into the water box, there ain't nothing fake going on there. They are they're trying to rip each other's throats out. And you got guys with huge egos, and you know, you get the guys that are there that they want to take on the big names, and it's as real as bare knuckle drag racing as you're going to get. And the fans absolutely eat it up.
Yeah.
And you know, I always find it interesting. I tell people, you know, if you don't like no prep racing, just go to one of a good event. Just go and check it out. Just as a civilian, even if you're not tuning on a car, just go have a burger, sit in the stands, and just watch it all unfold, and you will be totally amazed at what you're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, it's no different than grudge races. You know, we go and we've got a locked-in grudge race. It's kind of like No Guts, No Glory in Orlando last year. I mean, there's tons of people there.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what makes it fun, is the fact that there's so many people, everybody there is betting and wanting the other guy to win. And man, people act a fool when a car wins. They'll be jumping up and down those lanes, be running people down the lane. I mean, I'm like, it's amazing.
Oh, we love, as a media person, I love that, because I sit there, I lock onto that dude running down the track. I'm like, this guy's going to fall, and I want to get the picture of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good time. And, you know, we went last year and ran it, and the problem with the no time deal or the grudge race is, the reason we kind of get away from it is, I mean, once you win a bunch, like, it's all about a hustle anyway, and your chances of getting more races dwindle. And for me, when I go to the race, I like to race. The reason I kind of wanted to go to the RVW is because it's kind of set up 4 or 5 races a year. And with the workload that we have in the shop, I just can't make 8, 10, 11, 12 races a year anymore. I can, but
you'll hate
tells
life.
Me all the time, he's like, you race too much. I told him, I said, I don't understand what you're saying. He's like, well, I race 4 times a year, and I can bring a better package to those 4 races. you know. And I'm looking at it like that, he's spot on.
Oh yeah, at that level, you know, this ain't like a, you know, a, we'll say a 10-second bracket car. This is something that needs a lot of scientific help and work to make it function properly. And you can't beat on that car like it owes you money, because it's not going to respond very well.
Correct. Yeah.
And it's going to get expensive really quick, because connecting rods ain't cheap when you're, you know, when you're wringing the car's neck that much, right?
Yeah.
And I try, you know, I follow grudge racing kind of from a distance on social media and whatnot. I find part of it fascinating in that aspect that, you know, that it, to me, that's like one-on-one gladiator combat, especially like I wrote the article about, you know, J.R. Gray and the McCain boys that, you know, they ran that one back down at Bradenton. You know, they just showed up and raced. To me, that's badass grudge racing right there. When there's no like shootout purse or anything else.
There's not many people like JR. I mean, JR will run anyone to get a race because he likes to race.
Oh, he flat told me, he said, I'm deposit ready. If I've got oil pressure, I'm deposit ready. And to me,
that's right.
That's awesome. That's like the that's a grudge racer, drag racer through and through right there. You know, anytime, any place, anywhere, you know, my car's broke, I'll race you my tow rig. Just line up and let's race.
That's right.
Well, David, our time here on the Dragzine podcast is coming to an end, and I love to give my guests their chance to do their best John Force impersonation and kind of give some shout-outs, thank whoever they want to thank. So I will turn the floor over to you so you can thank you want to thank and let people know where they can find you at and what they can see what you do.
Yeah, I, of course, want to thank my family, God and my family. They put up with the 15, 18 hours a day, you know, hustle and bustle. All my customers that's kind of put me where I am now, give me the opportunity and put faith in me to make their stuff go down the track. I appreciate all them. You know, also, Phil, I guess, is that joker to put you on the map. All I can say, man, he does anything and everything that I need, business wise, outside of business. I can call that dude at 3 o'clock in the morning and he'll answer the phone. So for that, you know, I appreciate that. My business, you know, kind of taking off. If you need any type of chassis work, from simple roll cages to complete cars, I'll make a spot. And you can find us at Reese Brothers Race Cars on Facebook, Reese Brothers Race Cars Shop. I believe my son handles all of those things on Twitter and Instagram. So if you need anything, any type of apparel or anything, just hit him up, and he'll handle it for him.
Awesome. Well, appreciate your time coming on for sure, and looking forward to seeing what new rides you unleash on the Radio Versus World next year and seeing the other stuff you build.
Yep, I appreciate it. And like I said, there'll be some photos coming soon. And we're trying to do our shop stuff after hours, so it's taking a little bit more time. But they're going to start trickling out here before long. So I think it's going to be a cool deal to see a small block run in the bottom 60s.
Oh, that'll be a gnarly for sure, and I bet that thing's going to be screaming the sweet sound of a small block blower goodness at the top end, right?
Yeah, I would tell you that there's nothing better on this earth than a screw blower, so that's what we're going to have.
Awesome. Well, definitely appreciate your time, and I look forward to seeing you at the track.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks for David for stopping by, and as always, may your reaction times be crisp and your wind lights bright. Until next week, folks.